The jungle.
"Want to go up the tracks to the swamp and shoot frogs?" I shouted, aiming my slingshot at the rink boards behind the school. The ice had been gone for 3 months now, but whoever was supposed to take down the boards had yet to get around to it, which was okay, because Normie, Vaco, Rusty, and I had taken it over as our own little rodeo ground. Our bikes were horses, and we rode around in circles, no hands, steering with our legs and shooting at the boards with our slingshots, as if we were Indians closing in on the wagon train. There was a loud whack as my rock embedded itself into the punky wood. Normie let go with his high-pitched, phony laugh, the one he used when he figured he had it over on you.
"Ha, ha, ha! Here we go again with the frogs!" he shouted for the benefit of the others.
I wheeled into center ice and skidded to a halt. He did the same, sliding in opposite me, as if we were facing off for a hockey game.
"You got this thing about sticking straws up frog assholes and blowing air into 'em, don't you, RJ?"
I groaned inwardly. It was a trick I'd picked up from neighbor kids at my sister's farm in southern Ontario, and it was really neat, because with air in them, the frogs couldn't go under. They'd keep bobbing back up and swimming in circles until they farted little bubbles and disappeared. But the guys up here hadn't bought the idea, probably because I was the only one who got out of town on occasion, and they didn't like me coming back with foreign notions. Rusty and Vaco, chortling at the prospect of a dust-up in the making, pedaled in closer and stopped. Normie pressed his advantage.
"Gives you some kind of creepy thrill, huh, RJ?"
He glanced at the others, checking to see how his attack was going down. Usually Normie didn't faze me. We fought all the time, but Rusty was trucking out his back-of-the-throat cackle, the one he used to mock victims, and I was getting edgy. Hardly a day went by without one of us getting picked on by the others. There was no way of telling yet whether today's victim would be me or Normie, but I knew if I didn't deflect the heat fast, the honor would be mine.
"Know what we haven't done for a long time?" I blurted out.
They shook their heads.
"Sword fight with the goof bottles in the jungle. What do you say, Normie?"
I stared him down, certain I detected a nervous swallow. Rusty and Vaco caught it, too. Normie kicked at a patch of dandelions. We waited in silence for a response, watching the fluff spiral in the breeze, then drift upward and outward over the rink boards. Normie's lip curled down.
"Nah," he said. "Some guys got cut real bad doing that."
I saw the sneer on Rusty and Vaco's face and relaxed inwardly. This was working out okay.
"Who?" I demanded. "Give us a name."
Normie pulled his slingshot out of his back pocket and picked up a stone.
"I don't know. Somebody. They were talking about it at school."
"That's crap," I said.
"You're just chicken, too scared to go deep into the spooky jungle."
I began flapping my arms in slow motion like a ghost in flight, darting my eyes back and forth from Rusty to Vaco, hoping they'd join in. They took the bait, dropping their bikes, and like a pack of boogeymen, we began circling Normie with our arms undulating, his face growing long.
"Look at him," I said, pointing. "He's wetting his pants."
Normie aimed his slingshot at the rink shack and missed.
"That's a lie, RJ, and you know it." "Oh, yeah? Sword fighting with the bottles was fun when there was a big supply near the edge of the jungle, but now that you have to go deep to find them, you're turning yellow, and maybe afraid of running into one of those winos back in there."
The other guys laughed.
"Bull roar! Then how come you're always the one to collect the fewest bottles, when you know it's the guy with the most who usually wins? That's why it's always Rusty or Vaco or me, right, Rusty?"
"You're talking crap," Normie said. "It's not how many you get, it's how you use 'em that counts."
As quickly as it had begun, the torturing stopped and we mounted our bikes, heading for the jungle. As usual, there'd been no decision on what we were doing. It just seemed suddenly obvious and off we went, like a flock of shorebirds, climbing and swooping in unison for no apparent reason. We were racing now, because the sooner you got to the jungle, the more empties you'd collect before the sword fighting started. The object was to square off one-on-one and break the other guy's bottle. If your opponent broke yours, you were out for that round, so you reached into your cache and waited for another turn. The last man with an unbroken bottle was the winner, usually Vaco. He seemed to have a knack for turning the bottom of his bottle into the side of his opponent's at the last minute. My forte was the uppercut, because I fancied myself a boxer. I would bobble my bottle around like Rocky Marciano in a crouch, then come up from under with the bottom raised just enough to catch my opponent's bottle halfway between the neck and the boot.
The source of our material came from the hobos who frequented the jungle in the warm months. Some were local, but most came in off the trains and didn't stay long. They would make the round of the houses, begging for food, sometimes piling wood or doing odd jobs, then retire to the jungle with their treasures of cheap wine, catawba and four aces. There they'd bunch up in tiny enclaves till the hooch was gone or the CNR policemen rousted them. But the evidence of their passing lingered in the form of charred fire pits, scattered bread wrappers, rusting pork and bean cans, clumps of feces, which you had to be careful not to step in, and the inevitable piles of empty goof bottles. Rumor was the hobos carried knives. As usual, Vaco, bigger and stronger, was the first to cross the tracks from the freight shed, drop his bike, and disappear down a path among the alder and poplar trees. Rusty and I pounded in behind him, passing shards of broken glass from earlier jousts. When we caught up to him, he already had a pile started. "Them's mine," he growled, pointing to an open area that bristled with bottles. "And dis here's my territory. Go find your own." I looked at Rusty. We'd never been in this far, and the prospect of going even deeper had my pulse racing. I was about to suggest going back to the tracks and trying a different trail when I picked up Normie's asthmatic wheeze as he closed the gap. "You better get," Vaco said, "if you want to find them bottles." I lingered, weighing the options, troubled by Rusty's body English, which was flashing his intention to press on. Of all the people in the world, he would undisputably be my choice for a partner in a tight corner. But the prospect didn't make me any more anxious to court danger. On the contrary. Bravado aside, my tolerance for derring-do came in considerably south of Normie's, which was why retreating to the tracks and running smack dab into him would mean disgrace. The instant Rusty moved, I knew I was down to two choices, follow or flee. How many times in the decades to come was I to regret the decision made at that instant? But the die was cast. I plunged down the trail after Rusty, scared silly of what might lie ahead, but just as frightened of losing face. For a minute we ran and breathed in unison, like a team, and I was actually feeling better until we came to a fork in the trail and he pointed for me to go left. As usual, I did as told, but as soon as he was out of sight, I slowed, ears ringing. I could still hear Normie shouting to Vaco, but their voices were growing faint. Then it got very quiet, except for the noise from the lumber mill on the north side of the jungle and the blood coursing past my ears. The bush was thicker here, and darker. If somebody were watching, you'd never know. I stopped and turned slowly. Nothing. It was then that I noticed the bent grass, and my senses screamed to go back. But I sprinted on, scanning the bushes as they flew by, praying for sword-fighting material and cursing myself for calling Normie chicken shit. It no longer mattered that I find the mother load. 5 bottles, 3 bottles, 2, something, anything would do, as long as I did not have to return empty-handed. Then ahead I saw light, daylight. It didn't matter if it was just a clearing or if I had broken through to the other side. It meant safety. I raced for it like an animal fleeing the blackened woods for the beckoning lights of the highway. Bursting into the clearing, I bent over, sucking for air and blinking at the stars floating before my eyes. A full minute passed before the stillness exploding in my ears forced me to raise my head. Around me, partially concealed by grass and bushes, were logs and branches strewn in bizarre shapes. Squinting, I stared into the nearest log with Kryptonian intensity. It twitched. I jumped. My head jerked to the other stumps and branches. A booted foot moved. A hand came up, slapping at a mosquito. A burp ricocheted across the clearing. The ground was swarming with life. Armed with these facts, I could retreat with no shame, go back and report my discovery. But the circuitry that connected the thinking parts of my body to the moving parts had shorted. Nothing functioned. Feet refused to budge. Lips moved, but no sound came out. Knees trembled, but would not bend. Only my brain was going, 100 miles an hour. I was alone, deep in the jungle, surrounded by hobos, the same men we had taunted and jeered on umpteen occasions. I braced myself, waiting for them to rise, cackle, and extract revenge. But no one stirred, and gradually I began to realize why. They were comatose, passed out, blind drunk. Courage growing, limbs unlocking, I began to take stock. Here was a chance to strike a blow for the sobriety that characterized my church upbringing. Were these men not an abomination in the eyes of God? Had they not succumbed to the evils of alcohol, forsaken the pledge, buried their talents in the ground? One entered the kingdom of heaven through hard work, but this riffraff had ignored God's call to labor. My feet began to stir, my imagination too. An idea took shape in my head. Here was a chance to cover myself in glory in the eyes of my friends. I backed away, slowly.
"You look like you've seen a ghost or something," Normie said, pointing and laughing at my empty hands.
He glowed. His cache of sword-fighting material was impressive, mine non-existent. I sneered, getting ready to wipe the smile from his lips. Rusty lumbered into sight with an armful of bottles. They stared at me, recognizing from my face that something extraordinary had taken place.
"There's a gang of goof-hounds back there," I spluttered. "I got caught right in the middle of them." "What'd they do?" Vaco asked. "Nothing. They're out cold."
Normie went white.
"Let's get out of here."
"No, I got a better idea," I said, turning to Rusty. "Let's sneak up on them and break their bottles."
"What for?" Normie said. "We got all we need right here. Just because you weren't able to..."
I turned on him. "I'm not talking empties, numbnuts. I'm talking full ones."
"You crazy?" Normie said. "If they catch us, we'd be up shit creek. Tell them, Rusty."
But Rusty and Vaco were looking impressed, and feeling 9 feet tall, I pushed on.
"Geez, they're lying there dead as doornails. How in heck are they going to do anything?"
Rusty was stroking his chin, a smile poking out from the corner of his lips. "You ever watch those guys walk?" he asked, pushing his pants down so they were baggy at the crotch and mimicking a drunken waddle.
"Supposing they did come to, we'd run circles around them."
He stopped the impersonation and looked straight at me.
"I say we do it. Come on."
He dumped his bottles and motioned for me to lead the way.
"Why are we doing this?"
Normie mumbled as we headed down the trail.
"Remember what Mr. Larstone told us in Sunday school?" I reminded him. "About drinking being a sickness, and how once people start they can't stop and all?"
"Yeah, so? We'll figure it out, stupid. We'll be helping these guys stop, won't we? Isn't that a good thing?"
For a moment we walked in silence. Then I held up my hand. Ahead was the opening. My heart pounded. This was more fun than hide-and-seek at the experimental farm, or knock the tin can behind the Royal Theater, or even blowing up frogs. I felt like G.I. Joe leading a reconnaissance patrol into the jungles of Guadalcanal. We stepped off the path and hunched over as we pushed our way silently through the underbrush towards the clearing. Every few seconds we stopped to listen, but the only sound came from the saw ripping its way through lumber at Fontaine's Mill and a steam train backing out of the roundhouse.
"Holy snackabar!" Vaco exclaimed as we peered through the trees. The men hadn't stirred. Some were sprawled on their backs, others face down on stomachs or curled into fetal balls.
Flies landed unopposed on their mouths and beards and drank from the spittle that bubbled on their lips as they breathed. One of them had blacked out so close to an anthill that the foraging insects cut off from their food marched in a black line up and over his exposed belly and disappeared into the grass beyond. Crouching like Indians on a raiding party, we tiptoed into the encampment and began searching for Goof. After a minute, Vaco approached.
"This isn't going to be so easy," he whispered. "They may be drunkard and skunks, but they're clutching their hooch like it was water and they was foreign legion crossing the Sahara. What are we going to do?"
It was a good question, but I didn't have an answer. If we pried the bottles from their fingers, they'd wake up and we'd be sunk. Rusty looked at me expectantly, but when all I could do was shrug, he jumped in. "Poke around in the grass," he suggested. "There must be more somewhere." I nodded, but wasn't pleased. This was my show, and Rusty had a way of taking over when the going got tough. Like the time we put an arrow into the side of old man Bernard's cow. The rest of us had been ready to run home, but Rusty got us organized until we cornered the poor animal and pulled the arrow out. Just at that moment, the derelict a few feet in front of me sat up and farted. Rusty put two fingers to his nose and made a face. I prepared to bolt, but the man's back was to me. He rubbed his hands through his hair, burped, and began fumbling around him. When he didn't find what he was looking for, he rolled onto his knees, torso bobbing like a man at prayer, arms flailing the grass. Finally, he let out a long sigh and flopped onto his backside, bottled treasure in hand. He tore at the lead seal with his stick-like fingers, unscrewed the top, and began swallowing in loud gurgles.
"Holy shit," Vaco whispered. "Let's get out of here," Normie mouthed.
This time I was in agreement, but it was Rusty's show now, and he wasn't budging. None of us moved, but the hobo did. He pushed himself up and shuffled to the edge of the clearing a few feet away. If Normie had bolted, I would have been right behind him, but his feet had grown roots. Mesmerized, we watched the derelict reach the trees, pull down his pants, and strain. I knew what was coming, but closing my eyes didn't block out the sound of his bowels voiding their liquidy content, or the satisfied grunts coming from deep in his throat. Mission completed, he plucked a fistful of leaves, swiped at his backside, then staggered back to his dent in the grass where he collapsed, 10 feet from where I was standing. Heart pounding, stomach turning, I held my breath. The mill sawed on. Seconds later, he began twitching and bucking like a man suffering through a nightmare. Then the fingers clutching the precious Catawba loosened, and the bottle fell free. I stared at it and looked at Rusty, whose freckled chin was gesturing wildly for me to pick it up. The hobo lay curled on his side with one leg on top of the other, head resting on his outstretched arm and face angled directly into the blazing sun. For an instant, if you took away the knotted hair, filthy clothes, and stench of urine, he could have been my dad, up from the hardware store for a nap on the sofa. Moving like the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz, I stepped forward to extricate the prize. But in bending to capture the precious booty, I blocked the sun, sending a shadow across his face. The sudden shade must have sent an alarm to his brain, because the instant my hand touched the neck of the bottle, an arm shot out, followed by a scream. I staggered backwards. The hobo scrambled to his knees, propelling himself at me, indecipherable sounds emanating from his throat. The other men began to stir in a cacophony of grunts as they fumbled for their own liquid lifelines. It was only when I looked into his eyes and followed his helpless animal gaze down to my hand that I realized I was clutching his bottle. It occurred to me to hand it back and apologize. "Smash it!" Rusty and Vaco screamed. "Smash it!" I glanced at them quickly, then back at the hobo who was coming at me on all fours. Stepping backwards, I swung my arm in a wild arc, like a fastball pitcher winding up, and flung the bottle towards the fire pit. The hobo stopped instantly, his milky eyes following the prize as it rose to its zenith, began its descent, and exploded on the rocks. A wail rose from deep in his chest. He began to crawl towards the fire pit. "Mission accomplished!" Rusty whooped. "Operation Destroy Firewater completed! Let's get out of here, men!" I could hear the whoops and hollers of the others as they took off. "Remember the Alamo!" Vaco yelled as they pounded down the trail. "Geronimo!" Rusty replied. I stood riveted in my tracks, mesmerized by the hobo. I wanted to warn him about the broken glass he was crawling into, but no sound would come. He reached the fire pit, shaking his head in disbelief at the carnage, then flopped onto his backside and began rubbing his face. Tears and blood from his lacerated palms coursed down his cheeks.
"RJ!"
a voice screamed. It was Rusty, platoon leader, back to rescue boy soldier. "Coming," I said weakly, taking one last look at my victim. He sat hunched over, knees apart, arms limp at his sides, shoulders quaking, head sagging onto his chest. I turned and ran, but could not escape his lament. He wailed like a child who has lost his way, like a suitor shunned by a lover, like a soul rejected by its god. It carried across the clearing, through the trees, and dug a deep, indelible groove into my conscience. When I escaped the dark trail for the welcoming light at the tracks, the others were rolling in the grass, consumed by laughter.
"Geez, did you see the look on his face when the bottle hit the rock?" Vaco snorted, clutching his sides.
I moved past them, grabbed my bike, and started for home. Normie sat up.
"What's with you?"
he probed. I shrugged as I lifted my bike over the tracks. "Oh, I get it. Little too scary for you, huh?" I fumbled in my head for a rejoinder, but when nothing came, just kept on walking. I felt like one of those frogs whose asshole I'd invaded with a straw.